in August in favor of Brett Favre.
It's not a revenge factor. It's really not. It was a different week. It was strictly focused on winning a championship. It's always a sweet feeling to be a champion.
The Dolphins' victory earns them a home playoff game this Sunday against Baltimore. Looking ahead to the other first-round matchups, also in the AFC, it's San Diego against Indianapolis. In the NFC, Arizona takes on Atlanta, and it's Minnesota versus Philadelphia. Tennessee, Pittsburgh, Carolina, and the New York Giants all get first-week byes. For NPR News, I'm Phil Lantzman in Miami.
Two NFL teams dumped their head coaches today. The New York Jets fired Eric Mangini, and the hapless Detroit Lions fired Rod Marinelli. The Lions were 0-16 for the season, the worst NFL record ever. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication. On the web at annenbergfoundation.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Prevena Medical Group's Diabetes and Obesity Clinic, a comprehensive clinic that addresses the patient's special needs, including nutrition, fitness, glucose monitoring, and cardiology. Appointments can be made at 217-337-1300. The following is a required weekly test of the emergency alert system. This has been a test of the emergency alert system. This is WILL Urbana.
And this is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. We'll have another program for you from the Focus archives today, a show going back to 2005. Now, earlier this month, one of Wall Street's biggest figures, a man named Bernard Madoff, was accused of running the biggest financial fraud in history. And it was a Ponzi scheme where money is paid to early investors using money contributed by later ones until the whole thing falls apart. We thought it might be interesting to go back and to give you another opportunity to hear an interview about the man for whom the scheme is named, a man named Ponzi. This is a conversation with Mitchell Zukoff from April of 2005, talking about his book, Ponzi's Schemes, The True Story of a Financial Legend. This is an archive, and in this hour, Focus 580 will not be taking calls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about what is very likely one of the most enduring ways that crooks have come up with to separate people from their hard-earned money. And we're talking about the Ponzi scheme. And its most basic, it works kind of like this. Early investors are drawn into the scheme by promises of huge returns, and then they are paid with the money of later investors. And you can keep that going for a while, but only for so long. At some point, the whole thing collapses. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the man whose name is now associated with the scheme. His name was Charles Ponzi. And for a very brief period of time in Boston in 1920, he ran a scheme that brought in literally millions of dollars. It's estimated that altogether he took in something like $13 million. And at his peak of success, he was taking in more than $2 million a week. And remember, this was 1920. And in those days, $2 million was a lot of money. Our guest for the program is Mitchell Zukoff. He's professor of journalism at Boston University, former reporter with the Boston Globe, and he is the author of a recently published book titled Ponzi's Scheme, The True Story of a Financial Legend. The book is published by Random House and is out now and is a very interesting story. So we'll see if we can talk about some of the basics this morning. Mr. Zukoff, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine.
Call me Mitch.
All right. Mitch, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. I guess one of the basic questions we might ask to start out is this. Charles Ponzi did not invent the Ponzi scheme. He certainly wasn't the first one to do it and probably didn't put any unique wrinkles into it. So the question is, why is it that we have come to call this a Ponzi scheme and hasn't been named after somebody else?
It's a great question. You're absolutely right. He was not the first one to do it. It was called, as you described earlier, robbing Peter to pay Paul for centuries. It's one of the oldest schemes on the books. Just 20 years before Ponzi was operating, there was a guy named William Franklin Miller, who did a similar thing in New York and Boston, and we don't call it a Miller scheme. The reason we call it a Ponzi scheme is because he was so unique, he was so brazen, and he was so charismatic, and he just became so incredibly popular in such a short period of time that it became associated with him worldwide because of the tremendous skill he used in pulling it off. It wasn't that it was a particularly new wrinkle. Each one has its own sort of unique characteristics, but it was the power of the personality himself. He was an enormously charismatic guy. He was charming. He was dapper. He was only 5'2", but he acted as though he was 7 feet tall. And his popularity was spiked so quickly and was so global that we immediately began to associate it with him. I think also, just personally, I think there's something sonorous about Ponzi scheme as opposed to a Miller scheme. There's something about the name, I think.
Yeah. Well, and as you say here, over what was really a very short period of time, just a period of months,
yes,
between the time that he launched the scheme and the time that it collapsed, he became very, very well known, and people just lined up around the block to give them to give him their money. And it seems that he had a I don't know if it's saying rock star status is quite right, but
oh, it
seemed
is.
Like it was something that indeed maybe that was it was like that.
Exactly. I mean, in December of 1919, he was completely unknown, virtually broke, was sitting in a little office in downtown Boston, just sort of dreaming up ways to make money. And 9 months later, everyone was talking about Ponzi, and he did have what we would now call rock star status. There weren't rock stars back then, but, you know, these were the days of some film stars like Valentino. He had Valentino status by the end of 1920, by the summer even. So we're really talking about this incredible arc of popularity that starts in December or January of really of 1920 and peaks in August of 1920. And yet his name remains with us.
He came to the United States as a relatively young man. He came from Italy, and his name was Carlo
yes.
Ponzi. And he came to the United States, and we could talk a little bit about some of his early experiences before we get to Boston in 1920.
Sure.
But I guess one of the things that's really seems to be striking about him is that maybe like a lot of people who came to the United States, he had one great dream, and that was he wanted to be rich, and not just a little bit rich. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be really rich.
Exactly. He wanted to be as rich as a Rockefeller. And that was his motivating force. He came here after having not done well in college because he was too busy hanging around with aristocratic friends and enjoying the nightlife of Rome. And his family said, you know, Carlo, with your skills, with your, you know, intelligence and your personality, you will truly be the one to find gold in the streets of America. And he bought into it. And when he arrived here in 1903, he truly expected, and he came here with literally $2.50 in his pocket. And he expected to be rich in no time and be sending money back home. But as so many immigrants found, it was not that easy. And he went on literally an odyssey for about 15 years, traveling around the country, having adventures and misadventures, all in pursuit of this great wealth.
Yeah, as you say, he knocked around the United States and Canada. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of different jobs. His lifestyle certainly didn't meet with his hopes or expectations. He at one point went to Canada and was involved. He worked in a bank where there was a big fraud, although I guess he wasn't personally involved in that. But
correct.
He was guilty of, was found guilty of, and was sent to jail for check fraud.
Yes. The Canada experience really was seminal and is essential in understanding Ponzi. This was the first place that I believe he witnessed a Ponzi scheme or a Rob Peter to Paul scheme in action. The bank where he was working was running just such a thing with its own depositors, offering very high rates of return on investments by using the deposits of other depositors. So he was witnessing this, and then when it was collapsing, yes, he was looking for some money to get back to America. He passed a bad check, and it resulted in a couple of years in prison for him, where he also learned that, you know, he learned, one, that he didn't want to go back to prison, although it wasn't going to be that easy. He also learned that people with connections, people who made money, were always treated differently in North America. It was not about family connections. It was about how much you had. So this was a key time for him. And he also knew he'd never wanted to go back to prison after this Montreal misadventure.
Mm-hmm.
But he did.
When he came back, he was trying to come back in the United States. He was traveling with some fellow Italian immigrants, one of whom had been implicated in this bank scandal that we talked about. And so he was arrested again, coming back to the United States, and ended up into a federal penitentiary in Atlanta.
Exactly, for smuggling immigrants. He took the fall because he was the only one who spoke clear English. And it was not a great charge against him. But he took a very hard fall, yes, as you say, back into prison in a federal penitentiary in Atlanta, where he had to spend a couple more years. And yet, what I was incredibly struck by when researching Ponzi's story, that after he gets out of prison for his sort of back-to-back misadventures, bad luck, bad judgment on his part, certainly, he goes to a small mining camp in Brockton, Alabama, and does something remarkable. He donates, he saves a woman's life, a woman he barely knows, by donating the skin off his own back and his own legs when she's horribly burned in a kerosene accident. He's, you know, some people would be, after four or so years in prison, would be embittered, would be self-motivated, would be selfish. Ponzi was a really interesting guy. He enjoyed giving as much as he did getting.
Mm-hmm.
And no episode proves it more, I think, than the burn victim.
That's a remarkable story. I recall in the book that he's talking, I think the story is that he's talking with this woman's doctor about,
yes,
what the doctor needs to do. And the doctor says, well, I need a bunch of human skin. And if I could just get together a number of people who would each give me a little patch, then I could do it. But I would need to have all these people. And Ponzi said, well, you don't need to do that. I'll give you as much as you need. Take it off me. And that seems just a surprising thing for him to do, as you say, particularly for someone, it wasn't his sister, it wasn't a cousin, it was someone who was completely unrelated to him.
Exactly, and that you tell the story well, because that's exactly how it was. This was such a revealing thing of Ponzi's character, of his nature, and it carried through right up to the height of his popularity when he became a known man. He loved the idea of making other people rich. He was somewhat naive, and he was maybe a little bit, sort of willing to dupe himself as much as he was duping other people, because he got so much joy out of it. He was delighted at being the hero to this burn victim, Pearl Gossett. And even though he suffered horribly, he went through several operations, suffered pleurisy and pneumonia, and while he was recovering, actually his latest plan at that moment to become rich fell by the wayside. So he suffered horribly for it, but it gave him tremendous joy, and was always, for the rest of his life, a point of pride.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Mitchell Zukov. He is professor of journalism at Boston University. He is a former newspaper reporter. He worked for the Boston Globe and, in fact, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and also won a number of other honors for his work as a journalist. He's the author of a newly published book that is the story of Charles Ponzi, the man from whom we get the name Ponzi Scheme, although, as we said at the beginning of the program, he didn't invent it. He wasn't the first one to do it. But when he did it, he was so brazen, he was so flamboyant, he became such a well-known public figure over a very short period of time that his name got attached to it. And the book is Ponzi Scheme, The True Story of a Financial Legend. And the book is published by Random House. As we mentioned, he had these couple of experiences in prison. He was in prison in Canada. He was trying to get back to the United States and ended up in jail again. He knocked around some in the South, in the American South. There is this episode we just talked about. Finally, he ends up in Boston, and that is where the great scheme takes place. He arrives there, and apparently not very long after he does, he meets a very attractive young woman, and she certainly was. Her picture is in the book, Rose Necco, and he's just totally smitten. And so now he's still on the search of this great dream. You know, he still wants to get rich, and he sees her, and apparently immediately decides, this is the woman I'm going to marry. And he proposes, and she says yes.
She couldn't resist his charms. You know, Ponzi was motivated, and really sort of, to understand Ponzi, you have to understand his relationship to two women. First, he was desperately desirous of pleasing his mother. His mother was an enormous force in his life, who was telling him, as a boy, you are going to restore this family to its former greatness. and he talked about how she would build castles in the air for him. And the second woman, as you described, was Rose. When he fell in love with Rose, all he wanted was to drape her in diamonds and furs, put her in a big house, make her like the Boston Brahmins who ruled this town. And instead, you know, the funny thing, the odd thing, I guess ironically, is that all Rose wanted was a Ponzi home for dinner. She just was in love with him. She was charmed by him, and she called him her ideal. And he was a bit older than she was, and they had a lovely, lovely time together. But that was not enough for him. He was insisting that he wanted to see her as rich as any woman in Boston.
And it sounds like his attempts to make money so he would have the lifestyle to which he would like to become accustomed there in Boston, he still had some of the same problems that he had had before, not very successful. Her parents had a wholesale vegetable business, and he tried to get in there and help them because it was not doing well, and it went out of business anyway. He racked up a lot of debts, so he was really in a tough spot. And then he got this idea, which now sounds a little crazy, but he got this idea, and it's a little bit difficult to explain, in a sense, because it involves something called an international reply coupon.
Yes.
Which, as far as I know, there is no such thing. And
actually, no, they still exist.
They still exist.
Here's what it was. Okay. There's a simple explanation.
Yeah.
Basically, an international reply coupon is a way to buy a certificate that entitles you to get a stamp in any country in the world. And people would use them. They would enclose them, especially back then, when writing to someone in a foreign country, because it was a polite thing to do. If you were writing to your mother in Italy and you want her to write back to you, you don't enclose a dollar for a stamp because she'd have to turn that into lira, then go to the post office. You just include an IRC. And she brings it with her return letter to the post office and then gets the stamp and gives it back to you.
Mm.
Ponzi realized, and this is the most amazing thing, Ponzi realized that, what he had come up with was totally legal and theoretically possible. If you could buy these IRCs in countries in Europe where the currencies were depressed, bring them over here and trade them in over here in America, you could turn enormous profits. And it was true. On a very small scale, if you bought an IRC in Italy, whose currency was depressed after World War I, you could get twice as many or five times as many at different points here in America. It was arbitrage. It was what currency traders on Wall Street do every day in smaller increments. And so he realized in the summer, really, of 1919, that if he could get enough money together to buy these IRCs in bulk, bring them back here, turn them into cash, he would be rich. He would have every one of those dreams we discussed come true.
Hmm.
And it was legal. This was a legal currency. It was kind of an international postage currency.
Of course, the problem was, and maybe we'll get into this a little bit more, but the problem was that while indeed the plan was legal and possible in theory, that as a large-scale operation, it was not practical and maybe, in fact, not possible. And that, and going into it,
exactly,
he didn't really know that. He didn't realize that. He didn't really even have a plan for how he was going to do it. He just had this idea and said, wow, that's great. I can make $1 million. I can make millions of dollars that way, without really quite understanding or having a plan for how he was actually going to do it and make it work.
You're absolutely right, David. I've said he had about one-third of a brilliant idea. and the other two-thirds were, of course, that's where the rubber hits the road, was how am I going to, so in theory it was great, but how am I going to carry it out, and then how am I going to turn it into cash? We're never really part of his calculations. And he knew this on some level. He was willing to be sort of self-deceiving, but at the same time, as he is starting to put this plan into operation, I learned he was quietly, secretly being treated for ulcers for the first time in his life.
Hmm.
It was eating him up inside because he knew he had one-third of a brilliant plan. And he was desperate to find the other two-thirds, but by that time, things had gotten out of hand. Things had gotten away from him.
Well, I'll tell you, I have a caller to bring into the conversation.
Sure.
Of course, we'll continue to tell more of the story of what happens to Charles Ponzi as we talk with Mitchell Zukov about his book, Ponzi's Scheme. Questions are welcome. People want to call in and talk with our guest. The number 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Certainly people are welcome to call. We just ask people to be brief, as I try to mention that from time to time, just to keep the program moving, get in as many people as possible. But anyone who is listening is welcome to call. And we do have someone right here in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, I found it rather amusing that the federal inspectors, a few of the federal inspectors who were sent to check up on him, actually bought in as investors. But my question is, didn't he try and get legitimate? Didn't he try and buy a bank or something later on and legitimize his business?
Yes, he did. Actually, you're right on both counts. First, not only the federal investigators, three-quarters of the Boston police force became Ponzi investors at the height. One of the assistant attorney generals invested as well. So he was, you know, he was convincing to even people who were out there investigating him. And yes, when he was raking in all this money and he hadn't figured out a way to turn the coupons into cash, he did indeed. He bought a bank named Hanover Trust, which was right around the corner from him. He bought a macaroni company. He invested in all kinds of legitimate businesses, an import-export company where he had worked when he first came to Boston. So he very much was hoping, and you know, right up to the end, that he could go legitimate and pay off all of his investors. There are two parts. This brings up a great point, so thank you for the call. There are two parts of a scam. There's take the money and run. Now, Ponzi never had the and run part in him. He had no intention of running, and there's all kinds of evidence that he never wanted to swindle people and run and disappear. And so buying the bank, taking in investors as, you know, investigators as investors, it's all part of this evidence of a guy who truly believed he could somehow pull it off.
Do you have a copy of his actual presentation? He must have had a terrific pitch.
You know, it's funny. The nature of his pitch, none survive. Little pieces of his pitch do survive in the accounts of the day. But he wrote beautifully. He had an unpublished autobiography. And he was very, very smart. He was sort of a natural-born salesman. And what he told all of the people who came to work for him was, never sell them hard. He was the first soft sell. If he said, we have such a fantastic product here, we have such an incredible offer, that we don't need to be carnival barkers. We don't need to say, step right up. We don't need to be P.T. Barnum. Just quietly offer them the money, and they'll come running. And he was so right.
Well, thank you.
All right.
My pleasure. Thanks for the call.
Others indeed are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, once he had the idea, and you explained how it was he thought that this could be made to work, then what he would need, obviously, to make it work was some money.
Yes.
And he figured, well, I'm going to have to borrow this. And he knew that there would be little chance that a bank would give him the money. And then he thought, well, maybe I could find one or two people who would give me enough money. And he tried to go around and pitch it to individuals, and nobody apparently thought it would work or thought it was a good enough risk. And then he hits on this idea that maybe what he could do is to get small amounts of money from a lot of people.
Yes, that's exactly right. It demonstrates this was not designed to be a pure scheme. He thought he could carry it out, and it just happened that his only access to money was by going public, by taking in whatever people were willing to trust him with a promise of a 50% return in 45 days, which was such a great return that he sort of suspected people would come running, and they did. And so people did start lining up to trade their cash for what were soon called Ponzi notes. And they started coming in to his little operation down on School Street here in downtown Boston. And they left him with small amounts of money, just enough to test it out. Let me put my toe into the waters, come back and see if he can actually do this. And when 45 days came, Ponzi had not figured out how to turn the cash into coupons and the coupons back into more cash. So he had two choices. He could either abandon this idea, this one-third brilliant idea, or he could keep the ball rolling, keep the music playing, and that's what he did until he hoped he would figure out the right way to end it. Well, at that point, the only way to do it was by borrowing the old robbing Peter to pay Paul that he had seen at the Zarassi Bank in Montreal. And the student, as soon as he started doing that, he took a turn in his behavior that that he'd be paying for, really, for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that was, as the money started to roll in, he kind of liked the idea of having the money. I mean, after all, that's what he had always wanted, and he started to live like a rich man, and he bought a big house, and he bought a lot of nice clothes, and he bought expensive cars, and pretty much, I guess, he bought anything that he wanted.
Did he ever? Yeah, he, you know, I've been in the mansion in Lexington. He ended up buying the bank, as we discussed, and this is the bank that he had turned him down for a loan. And so interesting, he bought jewelry for Rose, and she took it back. It was too ornate. It was too fancy for her, and she was not an ostentatious person. But yes, he started living large, and he looked fantastic in these dapper Palm Beach suits with a straw hat on his head and a Malacca cane, a Malacca wood cane with a gold tip. And he became publicly the man he had always dreamed of being.
And I suppose that that just helped sell him and the product because of his, not only was he charismatic, but he looked prosperous. He looked like a very rich, successful guy. And I'm sure that people looked at him and said, well, look at that. He's a living example of what it is that he's offering to us.
That's
and,
a great
you know,
point.
After all, if you say to somebody, look, I have a deal for you. If you give me $100 in 45 days, I will give you back $150. At the time, the appeal of that, and there were plenty of people who were trying to sell various, you know, things like this, get-rich-quick schemes. I'm sure that the appeal for that was so great that that's why it is that you had these people literally lined up down the block, just waiting to get in the door so that they could give him the money.
That's exactly right. And he was, you know, and the caller actually made this point, he was the best salesman, as you say, because of how he looked. But also, there was something he did near the end, at the height of this, that was just brilliant. He was walking around downtown Boston, and in one of these beautiful suits, he kept a $1.5 million certificate of deposit made out to him. And if anybody questioned him or anybody sort of wondered about him, he would just wave this $1.5 million certificate and say, look, I have all the money I could ever need. You know, I'm doing this because I want to maybe run for politics, I want to be in office, and I truly just want to share the wonders of the wealth that I have started to enjoy and my family is enjoying. So that made him a fabulous salesman for his own product.
Yeah, and it's remarkable how quickly this took off. This was the proverbial snowball rolling down the hill because, as you said, we're only talking about here a period of months, say about 6 months or something like that. And at the beginning, when he first started out selling the Ponzi notes, maybe he sold, maybe he sold a couple $1,000s worth. And then pretty soon he was selling tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands and then millions of dollars. And it just happened that it just did indeed snowball, and it went that fast.
He was the right man at the right moment, and people responded, and people just could not get enough of him. And once people were walking, again, and he also knew that every time he paid off an investor with, again, the money of other investors, of course, he knew he had created a fantastic salesman. And somebody walking home with $250, you know, or $150 from a $100 investment wanted to tell the world, wait till you hear what I did. What a genius I am. I just made $50 by giving my money to Ponzi for 45 days. And people said, where's his office? And yeah. So, yes, they filled the streets. And there's a scene in July, by July of 1920, when literally people are just pressing against each other, hundreds and hundreds of them, desperate to invest with Ponzi.
And there, you also, as you say, the business grew, and it grew very fast. So it got to the point where Ponzi couldn't he couldn't do the work himself, and he had to hire office staff, and he hired salesmen, and he had an office, and that also sounds like that grew very fast too.
It did, and in fact, he opened branches all over the Northeast, and he was getting telegrams from people across the country saying, "Hey, can I open an Oklahoma City bureau? Can I open a California?" And so it was growing like Topsy. It was just people couldn't wait to be part of this because this man just had that ability to convince you. I am the answer to your dreams. And so, yes, certainly by the summer, it was growing out of control. And literally, the money was pouring into his downtown office so fast, they couldn't even count it all quickly or store it all. They threw it into wire baskets, almost like waste paper baskets, to be counted later. And just, you know, said, well, we'll deal with it later. And at the end of the day, near the very end, it was close to $1 million a day pouring in.
Yeah. Our guest, very quickly, I'll introduce again. We're a little bit past the midpoint of this hour, is Mitchell Zukov. He teaches journalism at Boston University and is also a former newspaper reporter. He worked at the Boston Globe and won a lot of awards for his work. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His new book, the one that tells the story that we are sketching out here this morning, is titled Ponzi's Scheme, The True Story of a Financial Legend. It's published by Random House, and it does tell about the life of Charles Ponzi, the man who, over this short period of time in Boston in 1920, launched this scheme, took in literally millions of dollars before it all collapsed, and became so famous, so well-known, that is why today we call this kind of scheme the Ponzi Scheme. And it's a really interesting story. So if you want to read more, you head out to the bookstore and take a look at it. And of course, questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a little earlier about the fact that, you know, initially Ponzi had this idea. He thought that he could make money buying these coupons and buying them in one place where the value of the currency was low, and then he could take it to another place where it was worth a little bit more, exchange the coupons for that currency, and then in the process make money. And as you said, theoretically, that could work. The problem was that, and also as you said, he had a third of a good idea, that he really didn't know. He really didn't have a plan for making it work. And when he launched the scheme initially, money started to come in, and he still didn't know how it was going to work, but he realized that if he could continue to get people to give him money, that he could pay the early investors with the money from the later investors, and that's sort of the basic of the whole deal. There had to have been some point. And you also talked about the fact that, you know, he's making a lot of money and he was enjoying spending it. But there had to be some point at which he realized this simply wasn't going to work. There was no way that he could actually make it work the way that he thought. And then maybe also at that point he started thinking that he could invest in legitimate business and eventually everything would work out okay. I guess the central question is, at any time did Charles Ponzi think that he was committing a crime?
That's a great question, David. I wouldn't say he thought he was committing a crime. I think he thought he was playing a bit fast and loose, but he was so convinced that his intent was good, as he always said. His intentions were good, and so, you know, if he had stopped to think about it, he would know that what he was doing was not on the level, but I don't think he thought of it in terms of as a crime. He felt that he talks a lot in his autobiography and at the time about how business ethics, you know, it was a time when rogues and rascals really abounded in America, and he was sort of doing what so many of them had done. He was playing a little fast and loose, you know, shading things in his eyes, but committing a crime, no, I don't think he ever thought he was doing that. You have to remember, Boston in 1920 was really a city that had been shaped by a mayor, James Michael Curley, who was one of the great rogues of early American politics, of early 20th century politics, a man who, on a $10,000 salary, built, you know, a $100,000 home with cash in the Jamaica Way in Boston. You know, there were plenty of people who were shading things and were doing just fine and were being celebrated and being elected to Congress or the mayoralty here. So Ponzi, I think, saw himself as, you know, taking, he saw his opportunities and he took them, I think is how one rogue once said.
Mm. Well, let's see. We have another caller here that we can talk to. Someone in Bloomington, Illinois, not too far away from us, on our toll-free line, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. My name's Bob. I'm calling from Bloomington. I'm in my car, so I'll ask my question and hang up. And I apologize if you already discussed this, but I didn't catch the first part of the program. Am I right that after Ponzi was convicted, He was in jail for a few years, and then he got out, and he went to Florida and was engaged in a real estate scheme down there. I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thanks.
Thanks for your question. Yes, in fact, you're absolutely right. He did, after he after things didn't go as he planned, and he had to pay a price for it, he did go down to Florida because the land boom was in sort of the waning days of the big Florida land boom, and he opened up a company called the Char Pond Land Syndicate, Char Pond standing for Charles Ponzi, and decided to sell land down there. And, of course, some of this land, it had the unfortunate property of being underwater, which made it hard to build houses on. But, yep, that's absolutely part of the Ponzi story.
And he did, as you say, I mean, eventually the thing collapsed. He was convicted. He spent time in jail. After that, I think he spent some time in Europe. He ended up in South America.
In Rio, yep.
And really died destitute.
Yeah, it's these stories unfortunately don't end well, usually for the people who carry them out. He did. He had $75 to his name, just enough to bury him. But as I say in the book, you know, what I found remarkable was one thing he never lost was Rose's love, was the love of his wife. They after he left the country, they went their separate ways to some extent, but she still loved him. And the letters that they exchanged back and forth that incredibly the family kept all these years and shared with me were incredibly beautiful. Some of it's almost poetry of a love story between these two people who really the saddest thing to me is that had his ambitions been a little bit more modest, he could have had a beautiful life with her. But because he was who he was, he squandered that.
One of the things that I wonder about, and I want to have you talk a little bit about, is what at the time, what sort of regulatory structures there would have been to apply what he was doing? Because, for example, there was no SEC. There was no Securities and Exchange Commission. That didn't come along until 1934.
Yep.
But there must have been banking regulators or someone who would cover what it was that he was doing.
There were, but David, you make a good point, because what ultimately benefited Ponzi, at least briefly, was that nobody was quite sure where, you know, he fell into the regulatory scheme. You know, there were, of course, fraud laws on the books, both state and federal, but people weren't sure he was committing a fraud. He wasn't quite a bank, although the banking commissioner here in Massachusetts took an interest in it because it was a financial operation. But there was a huge hole in the regulatory structure because he wasn't doing anything obviously wrong. He was paying people back. He was making a promise of 50%, and he was carrying it out. So no, there wasn't an obvious fraud. The regulatory structure that existed really had no way to deal with Ponzi, and that's why he was able to prosper even as long as he did.
Yeah. It's amazing how that even almost to the end, he was working really hard to maintain people's confidence and did indeed pay off a lot of people. And at some point even said to people whose notes were not yet due, he said, okay, if you want to come down here, I'll give you your money back. I'll give you your... He was not going to give them the interest because it wasn't due yet, but he said, your principal, just come on down. I'll give it back. And he did that.
Absolutely. And, you know, he felt that this was at a period when, you know, because there was a lot of scrutiny on him led by the Boston Post newspaper, which really was a bit of a hero in this story, you know, Ponzi was feeling the pressure, and there was a bit of a run on his operation. And, yes, he absolutely stood up and said, I'll give you your money back. I'm here to make good. And that only increased people's confidence. Each day he paid back more of this money, more people wanted to invest with him.
Yeah.
You know, in the midst of this, there was a great episode when, you know, he's under scrutiny, he's feeling the pressure, and he's walking down the street, and people are falling into line behind him. He's almost like a drum major at a parade. And somebody calls out, you know, Ponzi, you're the greatest Italian of them all. And Ponzi says, no, Columbus or Marconi. Columbus discovered America. Marconi discovered radio. And the voice calls back from the crowd, but you discovered the money. He was, you know, He was a hero to these people.
He considered himself only the third most important Italian.
Yeah. Very modest of him, don't you think?
One big piece here that we really haven't talked about, and you just touched on it, is how it was that the whole thing unraveled. And I suppose in part you would say, well, sooner or later, these schemes, there's a point comes at which they collapse. They can't keep going. But he had a lot of problems with this particular newspaper, the Post, the Boston Post, and the editor of the Post, who was, I guess, nearly from the beginning, very suspicious of Ponzi and what he was doing, and somehow believed that it couldn't possibly be honest, that there had to be something wrong with this. And the paper put in a lot of resources in trying to investigate him, and indeed eventually turned up the fact that he had done time for the forged check in Canada, and that he had this prison record, which caused at least some people to have some doubts about whether or not he was a solid guy.
That's right. You know, this was a really fun find for me. Being an old newspaper man, I was delighted to find the role that the Post had played in this. And Richard Grozier, the young editor-publisher of the Post, the acting editor and publisher, he was kind of a ne'er-do-well himself. He had never kind of come out of the shadow of his father, who really ran and owned the paper. And then in the spring of 1920, when his father took horribly ill and was completely incapacitated, Richard had to take over the family business, a completely untested guy. And yes, from the very start, he suspected that Ponzi couldn't possibly be doing what he said he was doing. And so Richard took it upon, really bet the farm, when all the other newspapers in Boston were scared to go after Ponzi, because they thought, well, if he's legitimate, he'll sue us, he'll own our presses, he'll take us down. Richard Grozier bet his inheritance, and which was the Boston Post, that Ponzi was not legit, and he led the investigation that did, as you say, turn up these things about Ponzi's past, detail how international reply coupons couldn't possibly be used the way Ponzi said he was using them. There simply weren't enough in existence. There weren't enough being printed to yield the kind of profits Ponzi was talking about. And so it really, the summer of 1920 is characterized by a battle of nerves and wills between Richard Grozier and Charles Ponzi. And not to overdramatize, but only one of them could survive, and they both knew it.
Yeah. And this was, as you point out, it was a time when a lot of the other newspapers were writing very favorable articles about him. They were writing these glowing portraits of him, of his wife, of his family life, of the fact that he, I think at one point I remember somebody, maybe this was just reflected popular sentiment. This was after Ponzi brought his mother over from Italy.
Yeah.
And someone said, you know, no guy who knows that he might be at risk of going to jail is going to bring his mother from Italy. It's somehow this family, this very rosy sort of picture of the family, was also another one of the selling points, and that was a kind of a thing that the other newspapers there in the Boston really helped to create.
Oh, indeed they did. The pictures from the day, and I've read all the newspaper accounts. You know, if you see a picture of a man sitting next to his 70-something-year-old mother and his wife, who who he hadn't seen in 17 years, and brings her over here, you know, that's a picture of trust, you know. This is not a guy who's looking to take the money and run. And so, absolutely, the other papers saw themselves as popularizers of Ponzi's efforts. And, you know, some of them were the small people papers, the Boston Herald and the Boston Traveler, who said, hey, you know, this guy wants to make the blue-collar guy who are our main customers rich. If we turn on him, then our readers will turn on us. So they championed him.
Well, let's talk with someone else here in Champaign County. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah. You started talking about the climate in Boston with Mayor Curley and that sort of stuff. It just seems to me that what we need is a big dose of, you know, things about the Roaring Twenties, the myth of social mobility. Mm. I mean, you were just sort of getting to that. The people wanted to believe this desperately. And it generally wasn't true. I mean, there were a lot of fortunes made, but most of them were made a la Curley, where you had to have your connections and you were shaking somebody down in some way. And he watched people flaunt their wealth and conspicuous consumption and all that, but he didn't realize that it wasn't really true. And the will to believe was palpable in that time, and I was actually surprised that it was at the beginning of the 20s. I thought it was a little bit later, and he crashed before everyone else did in some ways, but there was just a lot of that going along, and I kind of heard a glimmer of that every now and again, but there was real no, I don't know if you don't buy that.
I absolutely do, and in fact, I point out in the book that the climate and the time that Ponzi operated in is an enormous part of this story. And indeed, you know, first, I have to say, I think there are a lot of parallels to today. I think there are, you know, there's still a desire and a belief that you know, social mobility and riches are available to anyone with just a good idea and a will to work. And I look at the 20s and say that makes this era the dawn of modern America. This is a time when people did believe everybody could get rich. We were just after World War I. The stock market is starting to rev up. The papers are filled with stories about poor men sort of discovering something, getting rich, poor women marrying the wealthy son of an industrialist and suddenly being to the manor. So absolutely, this was an enormous factor in the culture. And I call Ponzi's rise and fall the first roar of the 1920s, because that was the time that was characterized by so much of this. And yes, absolutely, for most people, for most Americans, it was completely an illusion. It was completely their belief stoked by media accounts, stoked by the new, both the non-talkie and then later the talkie movies, that portrayed rich men as sheiks and, you know, with beautiful women, and it was slaking their, you know, it was sort of, you know, firing their desires. So you make an excellent point, and yes, I certainly see the time Ponzi was operating in as an enormous factor in his rise.
Yeah, the bubble economy comes to mind, and
right.
I'm glad you went on and made the modern parallel, because I think that's extremely true. And this isn't just a historical chapter. This is an ongoing part of the American mythology, it seems to me. Thanks.
Absolutely. Well,
thank
you know,
you.
If I can just elaborate on that for
sure,
a second.
Sure.
The you know, there's a wonderful new book. I promote somebody else's book, Conspiracy of Fools, about the Enron collapse. And Kurt Eichenwald, who's a New York Times writer, has characterized that as a giant Ponzi scheme. You know, the desire to sort of create something enormous out of nothing and then fudge the facts when it really comes down to it to keep the ball rolling is very much still with us today. And whether it's, you know, on the scale of Enron, which was, what, the seventh or eighth largest company in the country at one point, down to what you might get over the Internet in solicitations to, you know, get rich quick. So these forces are still very, very real within our culture.
Yeah, and it certainly, I'm sure that once Ponzi's company collapsed and it was revealed to be a fraud, that didn't somehow discourage other people from trying to do the same thing, or individual investors from lining up and wanting to trying to give their money to somebody else.
No, he just sort of, you're absolutely right, David. He just sort of made people think, well, okay, he had a problem, but somebody else will get it right. Somebody else will fix Ponzi's mistakes, and absolutely, the Ponzi's fall didn't do anything to stop other people from copying him. There are more today. In fact, I tell people, my dad is a retired New York City school teacher, and recently his retirement board sent him a warning to all the retirees in the system that to watch out for scams aimed at retirees, and the number one scam on the list was the Ponzi scheme. And so, no, it didn't stop people at all.
You tell actually a little story as a prologue to establish something about what the atmosphere was like. Mm-hmm. And a story that doesn't have anything to do with Charles Ponzi, and yet I think it's a great story.
Thank you.
This is the story where you talk about the fact that this also took place in 1920. Here was a guy. He was going door to door, selling what he said was a double your money machine.
Mm-hmm.
And you cite one example where he comes to the person's door, a woman lets him in, he comes in to demonstrate this machine. He takes this machine and he takes a $100 bill and a blank piece of paper the same size as the 100 and cranks it into the machine, and the lights flash, and pretty soon $200 bills come out.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, the woman says, hey, that's pretty good, gives him some money to buy this, and he leaves. And when she unwraps the package, she realizes that what she's bought is just a plain box. And that there was, the way this was received was there was at least somebody, and I think that what this was somebody who was a newspaper reporter writing about this, said, well, obviously, he had a real device. He had a real money machine,
right.
but the swindle was that he just sold her the box. And if he just came back and sold her a genuine money-making machine, there would be no problem.
Exactly.
It's just a hilarious story because it shows the fact that here at least was somebody else who believed, well, the problem here was not the guy was crooked. Well, he was crooked, but not crooked in the fact that the machine was a fake. It was crooked in the fact that he wasn't willing to give the real machine to anybody.
How wrong of him, don't you think?
I mean, exactly.
If he had only been more generous with this incredible machine, right, he wouldn't be in jail. How foolish.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's funny. When I came across that story, I was doing my research, and I came across that, and I said, boy, does this characterize the time or what? And, you know, we can laugh about it, and I think it is a funny story, absolutely. That's why I included it. But, you know, there are versions of that, and it's sad in a way. There are things still going on today just like that, where, in retrospect, people are being duped, people allow themselves to be duped, because there are two sides of human nature. There's the side that says, this is too good to be true. And then there's the other side that says, this is too good to miss. And it just takes the right salesman sometimes, the right circumstances, to tip the scales over to that the devil on that other shoulder that says, you know, maybe it's too good to be true, but boy, if I miss out on this, I'll never get such a great opportunity again. And that's what leads them down the path. And it's just, I think it's as much a sort of revealing of human nature as it is of a particular time.
Yeah. And that, again, that reflects back on the man himself and that he had the quality.
Yes.
And I suppose that's the quality that con men have of inspiring confidence in the people that they're trying to take advantage of. Something about them, the way that they present themselves, their charisma, something that they radiate is good enough so that they can persuade people that whatever the scheme is that they're trying to sell, that it's on the level and it's going to work.
You know the play The Music Man, Henry Hill?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the character. That's who Ponzi was. The guy who can come into town out of nowhere and convince everybody what they needed was, you know, is for their kids to be in a band. And he was the guy to supply it. And then, you know, it takes a certain personality. If you or I were the ones selling a band to Midwestern farmers, then, you know, in the 1920s, they might have thrown us out. But if a Henry Hill, if a Charles Ponzi comes in, just the right touch, just the right personality, they're throwing money at him.
Yeah. And well, it's a really fascinating story. And particularly, I think that it's fascinating to read when things started to come apart, how it is that Ponzi ran around trying to put out the fires here and there and really believed just about until the very end that he could pull it off, he could make it work. And that's maybe the part of the story we haven't talked very much about, but is there too. So hopefully now if people are intrigued and they want to read the book, they'll go look for it. Again, it's Ponzi's Scheme, published by Random House, by our guest Mitchell Zukov. He's professor of journalism at Boston University. He's former reporter for the Boston Globe. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, David.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. We first broadcast the show April 25th of 2005. There are many past interviews from Focus, also the afternoon magazine, local programming, available on our website. And you may listen anytime that you're ready. Just go to will.illinois.edu. The broadcast today made possible in part by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign, with plaques and promotional products to recognize all occasions, from athletic endeavors and musical moments to business achievements. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the afternoon magazine. And the host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll go to the archives, and we'll take a look at the economic, political, social, and environmental aspects of getting rid of human waste. Following the 1 o'clock news, we'll rebroadcast an interview with journalist Rose George, author of The Big Necessity. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, March wheat trading at 612, down 4 1/4. May, 627 1/2, up 1/4. In Chicago, March wheat, 592, down 7 1/4. July, 614, down 9. March corn, 398, down 14 1/4. May, 409 1/4, down 13 1/4. July, 419 1/2, down 13. September, 429 1/2, down 13. January soybeans, 942, down 9 3/4. March, 947, down 9 1/2. May, 958 1/2, down 9. July, 968, down 10 3/4. January meal, 294.50, down 3.20. January oil, 32.38, down 44. At the Merck in Chicago, December live cattle, 86.30, up 40. February, 86.40, up 30. January feeder cattle, 93.55, up 72 1/2. March, 92.85, up 110. February lean hogs, 59.20, up 25. February bellies, 87.05, that down 140. Outside markets, February crude, 38.58.